Welcome to the Zero Input Agriculture Podcast. And today we have a guest who has blown my socks off. He's a rare example of somebody who has devoted much of their lives to breeding a single genus of plants, the Hemerocallis, better known as daylilies, to all you normies listening out there. Brian Reeder is, there's so much more to him that I've just discovered, you know, just 5 minutes ago chatting. So we'll definitely have him back in the future. But to get us started, Brian, do you want to tell us about your background and the path that led you into crop breeding?
Sure. Well, I grew up in Kentucky in the United States, and both of my grandparents, or, you know, both sides, my grandparents on both sides were subsistence farmers. So I grew up with people who were producing all their food. They were growing their own animals, growing their own crops. And they were certainly using, at the time, this, I was born in 69, so this was in the 70s, the 1970s. They were certainly using, you know, the inputs that the agricultural system, you know, was suggesting, and they were spraying and things like that. But on certain levels, they weren't going all out with it. And so I saw that it was possible to raise plants and animals in a way that was a little more natural than what, you know, most ag was focused on. And I just had a sense from that, from, you know, that upbringing, that it was possible to do these things without so much artificiality. And then my aunt, when I was a child, had gotten very into garden plants. My grandmother had always been into garden plants, but she just had old-fashioned garden plants. And she certainly had like a Hemerocallis fulva europa, which is commonly called the ditch lily. And she had a few other types of daylilies as well, old-fashioned things like the cultivar Franz Halls or the even older cultivar Linda from A.B. Stout. And so I was just exposed to people working with the earth, working with animals, growing plants. When my aunt started to get more into gardening, she started ordering more daylilies. And over time, I started growing more and more of them and got really obsessed with them. And so I always went back and forth between plants and animals. And at one time, I would be working with, you know, goldfish. At another time, I would be working with chickens. But the daylilies were always there because as perennial plants, you know, they can survive for decades. And so whatever obsession had drawn me away from them, when I came back to them, most of them would still be there. But by doing that, I was also able to see that some daylily plants survived just fine and were still there 5, 6 years, 10 years later. Other daylily plants would have withered away and were gone. And so it started to make me realize that there are these differences in them. And as I came to understand genetics better through the years, I came to understand there's some genetic basis to this. And of course, now I know that some genes derive from some species, some derive from other species. The modern daylilies, of course, are hybrids of multiple daylily species. And so I sort of started looking for what is the basis of this? You know, why do some of these daylilies persist when others don't? And then as an adult, I did a long period of about 20 years of genetic research with poultry. I grew daylilies through that whole time period, but I didn't breed them at that time. But I was always looking at them and thinking, okay, this, I would do this, I would do that. And especially as I would buy more daylilies, and especially once the tetraploids became widely available and I started buying more tetraploids, every year or every 2 to 5 years when I would buy new daylilies, I would notice that some of those newest ones were not as good in the sense that they didn't live as well. They required higher inputs. They weren't as fertile. And so over the course of growing daylilies for about 40 years, I came to see that the breeders, in my opinion, were making extremely beautiful progress with the flowers, but they were ruining the plants in the process. And this is something I've seen over and over and over with every animal and every plant that I have worked with over the years, is that the breeders get tunnel visioned on some shallow phenotypic trait, some visual trait, and they focus only on that, and they let all the intangibles fall by the wayside.
Yeah.
And so a lot of my work over the years has been about restoration, about bringing things back to a stronger point of vigor and maintaining that, as well as, of course, my research work with poultry was in immunogenetics, so bringing in genetic disease resistance. And so that kind of...
One quick question. Do you have a vivid core childhood memory associated with daylilies that might have like foreshadowed the direction that your life was going to go?
But yeah, there is. And the really strong memory that connects me, my grandmother had a big patch of Hemerocallis fulva europa, the ditch lily. And of course, they spread rhizomatously. So they will spread, make a big patch and take over. You know, that's here in the United States, they're considered an invasive. And they will. You give them the right conditions and they'll spread like crazy and take over ditch lines and take over farmland. And, you know, they can get out of control. But she had a big patch of those. And I remember as a child going out and breaking off the fans and making them into rooster tails when I was playing being a rooster. And it is a really strong memory from early childhood. And then I also remember them gathering the flower buds to use in cooking. And so those are two things that really connect me in with the daylily into early childhood.
I think with me and cannas, I remember when I was young, my grandmother had a huge patch of them near her outdoor laundry, and she always warned me not to go in there because it was full of snakes. There were snakes everywhere over her property. They were just a fact of life. But yeah, she wouldn't let me play. But I just remember the big, juicy, squeaking stems as they'd rustle in the breeze, and just the texture. And yeah, it's weird. I wonder how often that's true. I've got to ask that question more of people who get caught up on a particular genus, like how deep does that relationship go?
Well, and for me, even deeper is the first plant that I ever owned that I bought with my own money. I was either 5 or 6 years old, and it was a daylily. So, you know, to go on, to carry on, there's a lot of things from childhood that connects me with them. And then further, my mother had made a rock garden in front of our house when I was 5 or 6. That's where my daylily was in my little garden that was off to the side of that rock garden. And she had put a lot of daylilies in it that they had ordered when my aunt ordered a bunch. And so over the years, they got tired of doing it. And by the time I was maybe 10 or 11 years old, 12 years old, that garden was still there, but it was somewhat grown up and weedy. And most of the daylilies were still there, but some had, you know, had died out or had been crowded out by other things. And I remember at one point I went down and dug out a bunch of them and brought them up and made a flower bed behind our house for them. And we also had iris and peony and other plants. And of course, the peonies had survived, but a lot of the irises, the bearded iris especially, had died out because they had gotten overgrown with weeds over the course of a couple of summers where they were adding onto the house and doing things and didn't take care of the garden. And so that is another early memory of seeing that, oh, these daylilies, they live. And so to me, it came down to a thing. I love their flowers. I mean, I've always loved their flowers. I think they're ideal garden plants. They are hated, though, by most quote unquote real gardeners now, which is an odd thing to me. But I also understand why. That's because they've gotten to where the plants are so delicate and the flowers can be so overdone and have a lot of bad traits. They need a lot of input. So they're not what they were when I was a child in general. But another memory, too, is when I was about 16, I had ordered some daylilies. And there was a special one that I had ordered that was called Golden Edge. It was the first of those. It was flesh-colored with a golden pie crust edge. And over the course of 2 or 3 years, it grew and did okay for a while, and then it just petered out and died out. And that was another of those moments where there was that dawning awareness of something, there's some variation here. I also remember very early on noting the variation of, like, the amount of branching and bud count, the amount of scape to fan ratio, and thinking, well, this daylily here is really fabulous, but this one over here has got this really pretty flower. Why can't those two things be together? You know, why is no one combining these two things? Why is it that the prettier the flower gets, the worse the plant's getting?
So, what are your priorities with daylily breeding? What are you aiming to achieve?
Well, it's the long view. My goals are something that will take me probably a few decades to really do because I don't have one goal. The end goal is a big giant plant with all the good traits. I like just massive, huge daylilies. I mean, and most people don't realize how big giant daylilies can actually get. I have daylilies now where the foliage is 4 feet tall and then the scapes are 6 feet tall.
Wow.
And that's, I want them that are just monsters. You know, I would like to get them eventually to where the plants are 5 feet tall or so and the scapes go up 7 feet, 8 feet, and are as big around as your wrist. You know, but that's decades. That's decades. There are so many other things though, because I can't see one trait and tunnel vision on it. I see the whole plant. I see the whole thing. And I want all the traits to be right. So, for instance, with an important plant trait to me is that the plant does not, there's a trait in daylilies where they'll form a clump, and after 2, 3, 4 years, the center of the clump begins to die out. It's called crowding out, or they go to grass, which means the foliage gets real thin and they don't flower as well. But all daylilies don't do that. And one of the things I've been doing now for a long time is selecting for plants that do not have the die out or go to grass. So I have daylilies now that can remain as a big, huge clump for 10, 15 years with no suppression of bloom and no die out. Because you think about the Hemerycalis fulva, the you know, Europa, the ditch lily, no one's having to divide those. This was my reasoning early on. No one's dividing fulva, no one's fertilizing it, no one's doing anything to it, and yet it's an invasive. Under the right conditions, you know, it has no problems. So I breed against the rhizotomatous growth. You know, it's fine and it the genes are there. I don't want to deal with it personally, but I think someone could take my plants and because I know I get rhizomatous seedlings at times out of the plants that carry the genes. So if someone wanted to use them for, say, you know, erosion control, which I know is an important permacultural concept, they can, you know, people could use my stock to select toward rhizomatous growth, but I've tended to select away from it just because it works better for me for them to be clump forming. But what I wanted to take from the fulvas is that they're not so tender and delicate that the fans start to die out if they get crowded. You can't crowd out a fulva, you know.
And you're doing unusual work too, because there's a constellation of ornamental daylily breeders out there, but you're specifically focusing on other traits such as edibility. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, in part that's true, but in part I'm just as focused on flowers as anyone else because, again, I'm looking at the whole package and I'm also looking at the long view. So, what I want to have in another 10 or 20 or 30 years is different from what I have right now in the sense that, okay, let me step back for just a moment and tell you how my program is structured in tiers, and that will help explain really what is happening in my breeding program. I consider breeding to be an act of braiding. So I knew going in I needed to develop different strands that could be woven together over time to eventually become one rope, one thing. So I have what is called the foundational layer, which are the four base plants that I have done the most work with, which are Hemerycalis fulva, the Korean clone of fulva, which is the best of the fulva clones, Bility, which is a cultivar that is from its mother, its pod parent, is the fulva Europa. Then I used a cultivar called Notified Ground Crew and a cultivar called Ancient Elf, and both of those are very primitive giant plants that are close to species. They're close to the yellow species, just several of the yellow species. So those are the foundational bases that I call species or near species hybrids. And they bring in all the plant traits that I want. Then there's the secondary layer, which are select hybrid cultivars that are selected for their flower traits, but also have exceptional plant traits. And it takes a good 5 or 10 years or more sometimes for me to determine if a plant is truly a secondary plant. So There has to be proof of that. It's not just someone said this is good, so I'm going to call it secondary. I prove that before they move into that category. And then there's secondary plus and secondary minus. Secondary plus is something that is so good I will back cross to it. Secondary minus is something that I will use and use heavily, but I won't back cross to it. And that's because there are some deleterious traits there that I want to avoid. And then the third layer of my program is the tertiary layer, and that's flower bread stuff. That's the fanciest and weirdest of the flower bread stuff. I do select through it and try to use the best plants possible in that regard, but none of those plants are going to necessarily ever going to become secondary. And basically, they only get used for a short period of time to bring some flower genes in. Now, at this point in my program, I started this program in 2009, so I'm a good ways into it. At this point, I never bring in plants anymore. I haven't brought in a cultivar in several years, from the hybrid population. I have the species base I want to work with. I have the secondary and tertiary level plants that I want to work with, and that's it. And what I'm now in the process of doing is braiding that together. So I only keep tertiary plants around just in case I want to dip back in for flower. But if you dip into those too much for flower, you lose and ruin the good plant traits. You don't really lose them, but they become recessive and they vanish, and you have to go through. And these, I'm working predominantly with tetraploids because diploids to me look like half a plant now. And the tetraploids have never really been finished properly. And this was a big basis of my program is early on, even before I started the program, and as growing the tetraploids, I could see there were problems. They were less fertile. They don't produce bee pods typically. There are problems there. And there are problems I can see from my work with hybrid jungle fowl in the research work I was doing with chickens that I can see those tetraploids have chromosomal issues. They've not been ironed out. Now, the peony people back when Dr. Saunders did the hybridization of the different peony species in the early 1900s, they took 30 or 40 years to iron the peonies out by taking them back to the tetraploid species or crossing the nearly sterile triploids with each other until they restored fertile tetraploids. Once you've got fertile tetraploids that are really strongly fertile, you've probably ironed out most of your chromosomal issues. So it's not that they were saying, oh, we're going to iron out chromosomal problems. They were saying, we want to get back to fertility. But the daylily people never did that. They were off and running with the flower immediately. And so the tetraploids have never really been fixed. And the tetraploids are bigger, but they're bigger on a less fertile, less vigorous plant. So my whole thing has been, let's make these tetraploids and do it right, and let's see how big we can get these. I mean, the doorway to true giants is through these tetraploids, but it's not through them with that are a chromosomal disaster, that have these problems. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to ask, are you ultimately aiming for a series of elite clones that like tick all your boxes, or a population that still has some diversity but is relatively stable to reproduce from seed?
Well, both.
I knew you were going to say
Now,
that.
yeah, because I'm never doing one thing. It's one of the reasons that I stick with in one genus is because I have so much going on in one genus, I can't think about anything else. I'm selecting for way more traits. Daylily people, when I was coming into this and starting to try to make the connections, with other hobbyists, they were all, oh, you've got to focus on one thing. Your ideas are too scattered. You'll never be able to do it. And I was like, yeah, but I'm going to do it over the course of 30 years, and you think you're going to do it over the course of three. So we're working on such different time scales that I'm moving in geological time while you're moving in human time, But it's both. See, I'm working with perennials, and most people coming out of permaculture are going to be working with annual food crops. And so it's kind of a different way of going about it. My focus is on what we call cultivars, which you could call clones. And but I also always keep a breeding gene pool in the background. So like for instance, the first generation seedlings that I made from crossing select secondary plants to my foundational near species plants. Well, I still have all that first generation. They'll never go anywhere. They're always there as long as I keep them. And by introducing stuff, I've been strategic about my introductions, and that I introduce stuff from every stage of my program and then sell those or give them away sometimes and send them out to hobbyists all over the United States. And so that way they're out there, and other people can make use of them if they can figure out how. And if not, they can remain in commerce and they're accessible to me. And then, of course, I live on the old family farm, and there's about 100 acres, and my program is on less than an acre because I don't need a huge amount of space. But then we have my aunt's garden here, and we have my mother's garden, and we have my brother and sister-in-law's gardens, and I have my plants in all of their gardens as well. So the select clones, which many of them are now cultivars, and introduced cultivars, are maintained and always will be. And I also maintain all of the original foundational stock. But the goal in the long run is producing for the daylily hobby these improved tetraploids that will, because the way the daylily people do it is entirely based on select clones, cultivars, introduced cultivars.
Do
But at
you?
the
Oh,
same time,
no, sorry, you
that's
go.
okay. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask
That's
if you have any general advice on people starting a breeding program on strategies for acquiring material. And often people are working on obscure plants where, anything you can get is valuable, but daylilies seem to have the opposite problem. There's so much diversity that's
Absolutely.
been named. Like, how do you even start choosing what you want to work with?
Well, that's a really good question. For me, I went into it knowing that I needed to go back to species. And I thus, knowing that I want to do tetraploids. So that drastically limited me because most of the species are diploid and very few of them produce unreduced gametes. So unless you convert them through, an artificial conversion to tetraploidy, you can't use them with the tetraploids. So that limited what I could go back to. So the fulvas are mostly triploids, and a lot of those are sterile or nearly sterile, but some of them are quite fertile, and some of those are fertile with tetraploids. So I could only go to fulvas for species material, and then to bring in the yellow species type materials at the tetraploid level, I had to search out things that were conversions out of primitive materials, so like Notified Ground Crew goes back to Tetrina's daughter, which is a seed conversion of Hemercallis citrina. And that's 3 generations. So even though it's almost 100 years, 75 years removed from the seed conversion, it's only 3 generations plant wise. So it's still really close to Hemercallis citrina. And so I then also knew the kind of flower traits that I loved and that I wanted to play with because I'm also an artist, and I'm not just going to have a field full of species looking flowers. I'm going to be tinkering with flower, and with phenotype, flower phenotype. So I brought in a lot of daylily cultivars of the flower types that I liked, and then I set up a 5-year testing program. And I basically put these flowers coming out of like high input greenhouse type culturing out into the worst soil I could find and gave them no inputs. And I said, live or die. And the ones that lived and then flourished are the ones that I made, that gradually became the secondary base plants. Secondary is flower phenotype. Foundational is plant phenotype, and so then it's a matter of braiding that together.
Do you have any advice for managing the logistics of, because you do mostly hand pollination and then handling the seeds, storing the seeds, growing them out. Like, do you have any insights from doing this for so long on such a scale?
Oh yeah, basically my approach is entirely lowest input energy conservation. So I'm not going to do anything extra. There's nothing extra going on here. If my ancestors 10,000 years ago could not have done it, I'm not interested in doing it, honestly. So I do hand pollinate. Daylilies are the easiest plants on earth to hand pollinate because the pistil is just sticking right out there at you. So they're extremely easy to hand pollinate. But yes, all of my breedings are hand pollination. Then I go through and I gather the seeds. And the way I pollinate, I don't do a whole bunch of different crosses that each cross has to be labeled like a lot of daylily people do. That's too much work. I will pick two pollen parents and for that season. Two, maybe three, and I'll try to pick one that's in the early season and one that's in the mid late to late season. And I will use the early one until it quits flowering, its pollen, and then I will use the late one until the season ends. And that way I basically, my program is a matriarchy. I'm basically, my major focus is on the pod parent because you always know who the seeds came from. So I'm not concerned if there's accidentally a, you know, a bee did the cross before I got there. You know, a lot of people emasculate and no, I'm not doing all that. So, I mean, I realize it's useful and that people should do it in the right context. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. I'm saying I'm not doing it. I don't want to do it. Another thing with the tetraploids is most tetraploids are not fertile enough to make a lot of bee pods. So it's not a huge concern. And a really interesting thing with some tetraploids is that they're perfectly fertile when they're hand pollinated, but they make very few bee pods. And so those are very handy because you can be pretty certain. But then
Oh,
another thing with knowing who the
to
pollen.
clarify, sorry, a bee pod is when a bee pollinates the flower and you get pods that you weren't expecting.
Yeah, exactly. In the daylily world, the hobbyists call those bee pods. And so it's just, you know, open pollination. Open pollination is the correct term.
So
I've had to.
if you label the seed and you know the mother parent and you've got a short list of probable pollen parents, then you can usually identify the parentage of a seedling if it
Yeah,
catches your
that's
attention.
what I was about to say. Yes. And because the pollen parent will often be very distinct, and the early season pollen parent, I will try to pick something very distinct and different phenotypically from the late season, so that I really, there's just no way the early season produced this, or there's no way the late season produced that. You know,
It's clever.
different colors. Yeah,
Very clever.
exactly. Yeah. And so then I, you know, when the seeds are, when the seed pods are starting to crack open, when you can squeeze them just with a least little bit of pressure and they'll pop open, I gather them. I use paper bags and go out in the field and gather them, label, you know, what the pod parent is. And then in my record book, I write down every year what pollen parents I'm using. So it's recorded. And then I bring them in, I shell them out, I put them in little containers and set them on a shelf. They're sitting on the shelf downstairs right now, and they'll be there until either I have to dust downstairs, at which time I'll put them in Ziploc bags and put them in the refrigerator, or I'll just directly plant them. I told you the other day in an email that I was putting out straw for the new seedling beds, and that is because I'm hoping to plant at the end of November if we're cold enough by then. And as far as like taking care of the seeds, I know daylily people who take every individual seed and plant it in an individual little pot, and I'm like, just kill me. I am not doing all that. And I can understand a lot of them maybe are only working with 100 seeds or 1,000 seeds, but I'm working with 10 or 20 or 30,000 seeds in a year. At the peak of my testing portion in the early part of the program, I was doing as many as 100,000 seeds a year. So the way I plant my seeds is I dig a little trench, I throw the seeds in it, I cover it, and I walk away. And good luck. Good luck. Because I want the competition. And when I say I throw the seeds in, I'd make no effort to try to spread them out or try to give them enough room, you know, for every seed to reach its potential. I have planted rows where when you turn around and look at it, instead of seeing like individual seeds dotting down a row, it looks like you've laid a black water hose in the ditch. I mean, I will just literally throw them in to where it's 4 inches thick of seeds, you know. I don't care because what I'm looking for It's always about just really giving them the roughest treatment possible, because I want the ones that flourish in the roughest conditions. Because if they're flourishing in the roughest conditions, they're going to flourish in most other conditions. And what's really interesting with my program, early on, people were like, well, you're going to adapt your program to where they will only do well in rough conditions. And I said, no, that's not how nature works. That's not how this works. And what I'm finding now is, as my cultivars go out into other gardens and they are putting high inputs into these plants, they're doing things in those gardens they don't do here. They're getting bigger. The flowers are bigger. The flowers do even more fancy things in these other gardens where they're getting the high inputs. And yet they still look great and flourish in mine. It's just that if they then get high inputs, they do even better for those fancier type cultivars, you know?
Do you
So,
find selecting for environmental resilience, it actually takes multiple years because every year is a bit different. They have to hang
that's
around
right.
long enough to have a really dry year and a really cold year to
Yes.
really see their full potential. Whereas the more traditional breeders, they just want to see that first flower, take a photo of
That's
it,
right.
and it has traits that they're looking for, and then that's enough for them to move on to the
That's
next.
right. Other than disease resistant selection, I really don't start making selection up until the plants are maybe 4 or 5 years old. Now, most daylily breeders are introducing their seedlings between 18 months and 3 years. I don't really start selection till 5 years, and most of my cultivars are introduced at somewhere between 5 and 10 years.
Now, I noticed as well, you talked about breeding for pest and disease resistance. Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Would love to. The two main things I have selected for are rust resistance and thrips resistance, because rust resistance is just a problem in the southern part of the U.S. It's not really a problem for me. I do not have endemic rust. But because I did those years of immunogenetic resistance testing in poultry, I knew how to do it. And this was a problem the daylily world was facing. And so the first 5 years of my program, I was bringing in new plants anyhow, and I was going to get rust when I brought plants in. It was just a given. So I just used that as a time to do rust resistance selection. And of course, rust resistance, we know from wheat, is not something that's permanent. But if you go with the very most resistant lineages and you then pyramid resistance and build broad-based resistance, in other words, multiple genic resistance, you have a better chance of it lasting much longer. But then also, when you may lose resistance for one of those genes over time as the rust resistance, excuse me, as the rust pathogen evolves, but you will not lose them all typically. And so you can keep breeding from those, and keep selecting for resistance in plants as new forms of rust emerge, because that's just, that's the arms race of pathogens, with their host. I don't do rust resistance selection anymore, because once I had finished with that period and I closed my program and quit bringing in new plants, I don't have rust. And so I was not going to bring in plants just to have rust. But that was something I did specifically for the people who are concerned about that. And so my plants often go out to people who are doing rust resistance selection in the deep south of the United States. And they are integrating my plants into their programs. My real resistance selection program is for thrips resistance, because thrips resistance is a problem. Thrips are endemic throughout the United States. They're quite endemic here where I live. And they create annations on the buds, which is a problem for any culinary purpose. And all daylilies, for the most part, are quite susceptible to thrips. And so finding plants with some resistance to thrips was quite a challenge. And then once I did, I've been able to start selection. And there are no plants that are immune, but I have plants now that have quite high thrips resistance. And in addition to the annations on the back of the plant, which makes them just, unpalatable, because who wants to eat thorns and knots and bumps? It also, a severe thrips outbreak can cause all the buds to drop. Or some of the buds to drop. Well, that's going to cause a problem in any commercial endeavor with them as a culinary product. So I considered thrips resistance to be the most important selection in terms of any permacultural applications, but it's equally important on the flower side too, because the thrips cause the plants to be spotty, or the flowers to be spotty and deformed. So thrips resistance I see as absolutely essential to both the permacultural culinary side of my work and the floral hobbyist side of my work as well. And that's my major focus. Now, I will say that my main F1 breeder plants all came out of that rust resistance selection period, and all have strong rust resistance. And the reason that was important to me is because as climate change progresses, there's nothing to say that rust is not going to become endemic in my area. And I don't want there to be a situation where I'm 30 years into this program and suddenly rust is endemic in my area, and surprise, surprise, none of my plants have resistance and I have to start over or throw the whole thing out and quit. So I know that there is resistance in the base of my program, and because I will be doing a certain amount of inbreeding, that's going to remain there. I'm not going to be doing a lot of outcrossing by, inbreeding. If all the plants, even where I'm not tightly inbreeding, even where I'm crossing within my own lines, both lines are coming from strongly rust resistant plants, what I call the A plus level or seemingly immune, then I'm combining rust resistance genes and I'm pyramiding even without selection. Now, of course, it would be better if I could do selection, but since it's just like an insurance policy, it's not a focus at this point. But a really interesting thing that I did find during my rust screening program that was in those first 5, 6 years was that there is a friend of mine who I'm actually really good friends with. I would consider him a breeding partner, although he just does floral, who was breeding up north, could never do any rust resistant selection. But because of the specific cultivars he was using, he was inbreeding resistant plants without knowing it. And it turned out that his plants, a lot of his introductions and then seedlings I grew from seeds he gave me, would be the whole Grex, the whole family would be resistant or show really high resistance, even though he had never selected for it. It was strictly from inbreeding resistant plants.
Can you
And
tell me
he was
more?
inbreeding them for flower traits.
Can you tell
Yes,
me
go ahead.
more about the use of daylily as a culinary crop, as a food crop, and also about
Yeah,
how
absolutely.
you breed that those traits?
Well, they're not really a culinary crop in the United States, although some people do harvest, feral Hemerocallis fulva Europa pods and eat. My grandparents did, a lot of country people did. That's the reason Europa is all over the United States, is because the settlers took it with them because they knew it was a viable food option. Now, one of the most important things, and one of the main reasons I have any focus on it being a food item, is that daylily flowers have a tremendously high quantity of vitamin C. And in an environment where vitamin C is naturally low in the environment, though, they could be a lifesaver. And that I think may have been one of the things the ancestors, the settlers, were doing without even realizing it, was that they were relying on them for vitamin C. But anywhere you see where there's been an old homestead, or there's been, where the settlers went through in the wagons, in the Midwest, you find these Hemerocallis fulva Europa because they were taking them with them. And they were taking them because they're such a tough plant and because they had this culinary use. But the real culinary center for Hemerocallis is Asia. They have eaten them for millennia. They call them golden needle. So if you ever see references in Chinese cooking or in a Chinese restaurant to golden needle, that's Hemerocallis flowers.
But they dry them, I think.
They do dry them. They also sometimes cook them raw. Now, the reason they dry them is just because that's better for storage. But in an actual farm setting, they would probably eat them raw more frequently. Not raw, excuse me. They would cook them raw and not dried. They don't tend to eat the raw vegetable. It's cooked. And we had in the email we had mentioned the that some people say that some daylilies have mild toxic effects, and I think one of the ways the Asian people get around that is by not eating them raw, they eat them cooked. And then another use they have for them is that it's a medicine. The Hemerocallis fulva, the orange forms in Europe, are called the sleeping flower. And they are mildly, I don't want to, what's the right word? I would say they're mildly hallucinogenic. They have a mild psychotropic effect that is sedative in nature. They're a sedative. And they're used for calming stress and for, anxiety and for any kind of mental type issues, that would be causing mental stress. That's one of the main things that they use. So they have, millennia of use in Asia. And they basically use the tall yellows like citrina, which is citrina, Hypericalis citrina is the biggest crop that they grow in Asia. But they also use the fulvas. And those are the two main food forms. So I think, from what I understand, any given daily species may be used as food in Asia, depending on where you are. But as far as like big production, that's being done with with fulvas and with citrinas. And so the way I select for it is basically just my program is rich in citrina and fulva. So I went by chance to the things that are the main food crops in Asia to begin with. So that's there. And then the other way I do it is I just nibble around on them here and there. I find them quite tasty raw. They're very sweet. They're like a really sweet lettuce. And I just have the tendency to nibble around on them when I'm out in the garden working and just see what happens. Now, if you eat too much, they can give you diarrhea, especially if you're not used to eating them. I don't eat them in large quantities. A lot of times I'll just sample the taste and then spit it out. Not because there's anything wrong with it necessarily, but because I just don't want to eat that much of it that day raw. I do gather them then. What anything that I know, oh, this tastes really good, and the effect is not overwhelming. That's something that I know I can then cut some buds or cut the spent flowers. They're daylily flower growers, who are the floral people, do this thing called deadheading, where they go in and break off the spent flowers every evening or in the morning. Well, in Asia, they tend to gather the aging flower. The flower only lasts one day. And so for drying, they can take the flower at the end of the day and they don't have to pick the buds. So a lot of times when I'm out, I don't deadhead much, but when I'm out at the end of the day, if there's something blooming and that I know tastes good, I will break some of the old flowers off. Or if I've been hybridizing with it, I'll just break off the petals and not break off the whole flower. And bring those in and cook them with whatever I'm cooking that night. And so I just sort of, I'm my own guinea pig and I just experiment. Now I have run across a few that I would consider quite psychotropic. I have a few things here that, you accidentally eat too much, you're going to trip for a while. You're going to see a lot of pretty colors. You're going to feel really laid back and sedate. And, I'm not recommending them to people. I'm not even going to say which ones they are. But there are a few of my introductions that if you really think about the names, you'll realize there's a double entendre.
I
And
mean,
that's
if in
why.
th in theory, somebody could breed Hemericallis to be a medicinal plant, but I with any of those properties, I guess there's an unknown about what like the long term or the high dose risks might be.
Absolutely, absolutely, which is why I don't really endeavor to do that much. It's not a focus for me. Here's the way I look at that. I know those genes are there. I know those chemicals are present in some of them, at least, if not all of them. I think that someone could take, just like some of the work I did with poultry that then went on into the poultry industry, I think someone who wants to work with the nutraceutical applications, the pharmaceutical and nutritional applications, could take plants from my program or take stock from my program and work with it and take it into the lab and figure out exactly what's going on. So basically, what I'm doing is I am trying to keep all the good things about Hemericallis, both the species and the hybrid populations, intact within my program so that my program can be like a base for others to use no matter what direction they want to go with it.
It
And
remind
my own,
Oh, sorry, you
go
after
ahead.
you, sorry, I interrupted.
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say that This idea of edible or toxic as being these two categories that we drop plants into is really oversimplified, particularly in Southeast
Absolutely.
Asia. In Southeast Asia, they have a culinary culture where one dish will have like 20 different plants in it, but all in little tiny amounts. And often those later, if you eat them in large quantities, they prove to have damaging effects, but in low levels, the benefits outweigh the risks. They might even have, mild therapeutic medicinal effects that aren't fully understood. And yeah, I think our simplified Western palate, where it's like, this is edible, you can eat as much of it as you want, is it's lacking that nuance. Like all
Absolutely.
yeah. Sorry, after you.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that part of the problem in the West, in the whole Western world, is that we want to be able to grab it and eat it. We don't want to take the time to go through three strainings of boiling, you know. We don't, you want it, it everyone wants it instant. They don't want to have to take responsibility for, oh, I cook too much of this, that, you know, they want to be able to grab up a handful of something and eat it, or throw it in a pot and cook it up real quick, you know. Where in Asia, they're willing to, you know, spend all day cooking and draining and preparing and preparing it in a way that makes it edible and makes it usable. So I think it's just a cultural difference. I think it's just that the West is kind of more into instant gratification, and nuance is kind of lost in that setting.
And even like tasting your food to decide whether you want to eat it is such a foreign idea. Like you bought a kilo of something from the shop and you expect it to be exactly the same as all the other times you've eaten it. And we're so hard, but it's so different when you grow something yourself. Like a particular plant might be having a difficult season and it doesn't taste quite like it's worth eating at that time when you give it a try. That's a kind of lost attitude towards selecting food that I think it could be reinitiated in people with a little bit of training and awareness.
Absolutely. A good example of that is, as a child, my grandparents would grow corn. My grandmother would go out and break off a ear of corn and sample it right there in the field. And if she didn't like the taste, she would say, okay, this row, this type, all of this that we've grown, that's going to go to chicken food this year, you know. But then the next year, that same type, you know, they'd save some seeds from that. The next year, the same type, then might have a better year, as you say, and she would like the taste of it. And so this was not going to the chickens that year. That year, it was going to the table. And so it was just, it would depend. Yeah.
I love it.
It would just depend.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, you keep going.
Well, I was just going to say, so in my program, basically what I want are big, giant, huge plants with extremely strong fertility that behave like the species, but on these robust forma, you know, that have the fancy flowers, that are beautiful, that have all of the weird fancy traits, that look like orchids or look like, you know, whatever they look like pansies or, you know, whatever. I love the art of the flower breeding, but I always say Leonardo da Vinci would not have painted the Mona Lisa on a piece of tissue paper. And that is what I have always felt like the daylily fanciers are asking me to do, is to waste my life producing this art that's on this plant that can't survive natural conditions. And so that's a thing that bothers me. Basically, the reason I'm so focused on the plant is because, one, I understand the evolutionary necessity of that, but two, I want an ideal canvas. I want my art to survive, but I don't want my art to just feed the soul. I want it to be able to feed the body. So my program is focused toward, they're going to be big, they're going to be fertile, they're going to be vigorous, they're going to have these beautiful flowers, but in times of need, you can also eat their flowers.
I love it. Hey,
In times of extreme need, you can eat their roots.
yeah.
Go ahead.
The really fun question I always ask at the end of the crop breeding section is if you could wave a magic wand and create any crop that you can dream of, what would you kind of summon into existence?
Oh, I would put really high levels of CBD in the Hemerocallis. because I don't like THC, but CBD is really good for me. I have some autoimmune issues like fibromyalgia, and so I will often have really intense pain if I do a lot of physical work, which I do. And CBD works for me, and THC doesn't. And yeah, they would be really high CBD.
Wow. I love that. I love that. And yeah, I see so much potential for breeding medicinal plants. There's just a couple like opium and marijuana that have gotten lots of serious attention. And they're, I mean, opium can have very therapeutic uses in emergency situations. And we're finding that the chemicals in the marijuana plant have lots of therapeutic uses as well. And it just makes me wonder, like there's of the thousands of other medicinal plants out there that are used in more or less a wild form, what's the missing potential there to start breeding them as useful medicines?
Yes. I will also say that when I have a really bad fibromyalgia flare up in the summer, I know that there are certain daylily flowers I can eat that they're not going to address the pain. They're not going to do anything for inflammation like CBD does. They're going to make me care considerably less. And you can guarantee that I'm nibbling around on those all day when I'm out working if I'm in a lot of pain. And I select for that too. I know the lines that do it. I'm not advertising it. I never talk about this. You're the first person I've ever spoken with this about, but it is a thing I am aware of. And as I've said throughout this, I'm not selecting for one thing. I've got lines that are more toward this, and lines that are more toward that, and lines that have this trait, or lines that are more culinary, or lines that are more medicinal. And I'm not asking anyone to do the things I do with them. I'm not suggesting anyone should. But I certainly experiment with all of these things myself, you know? And I have an awareness of them. Now, another thing also, you know, the species only come in orange and yellow. But in the fancy cultivars, we have a whole range of colors. And I have noticed that the flavor is different based on the color. So some of these fancy hybrids that are, say, in pink or purple will have different palate effects, they have different tastes. And I'm certain that it's because there's more or less of various types of anthocyanins and other chemicals. One of the reasons that it's been important for me to keep a wide range of the colors and to work with the non-species colors, the fancy domestic colors, is because who knows what chemicals are present in those? Who knows what daylily breeders selecting only for flowers probably, almost certainly, have been selecting for a lot of other traits that they don't know or understand. And so by keeping all of those things there, that is available to other people in the future should they ever want to pursue it.
What about the low input side of your growing? Are there particular inputs that you've managed to eliminate, and how has that changed your management?
Well, I've eliminated all inputs. I don't do any inputs. I don't water, I don't fertilize, I don't do anything.
Well, that's a open and shut case.
I don't do soil amendments. I don't put down mulch. I have them growing in grass. We mow around them. I don't do any of it. The only thing that I do is when I'm planting seeds, I put down a good thick layer of straw, probably 4 inches of straw before it's pressed down. And then by the time the seeds are starting to come from the spring, of course, winter snows have pressed that down to maybe an inch or inch and a half or something. The seeds come right up through it. I plant them in a little ditch, maybe a half inch or an inch deep under the straw. And that straw will be there through their first year, and I will weed them through the first year. But once a seedling bed is into its second year, I have a small battery-powered push mower. And I have the rows about 2 feet wide so that I can get this 14-inch mower through them, and I mow between them. And so I don't do any weeding. I don't do any chemicals of any form. I don't spray for weeds. I don't spray for bugs because I can't do the thrips resistance testing if I'm spraying for thrips. I do no inputs. I do no soil amendments. And I go out of my way to use the worst soils on the farm every time that's possible. Because, and the thinking behind that is the Hemerocallis fulva, the Europa, the ditch lily, survives everywhere and is an invasive plant.
Yeah.
And I
Yeah.
keep going back to that because what that means is they flourish in all conditions. Now, they're not invasive everywhere. My soil here, I'm on a south-facing hillside that is a combination of sand and clay with very little topsoil. So Europa will not get very invasive here. They'll make a little patch, but they won't take over. That's typically in really good quality, wetter, better quality soils that they
Yeah.
become really invasive. But they still survive and they still flourish and they don't have to be divided and they get no inputs whatsoever. And if Hemerocallis fulva can grow like that here on my farm, then that means the genes are there in the genus for that, especially since fulva is pretty heavy in the base of my breeding. And so I just decided, I want to go to an extreme with this. I want to take this to an extreme level. And it's based in, Liebig's law of the minimum, which is that the least available nutrient is the limiting factor. So I decided, well, let's put in a bunch of limiting factors and figure out what can survive that.
Yeah.
And so my whole breeding program is based in that. And I'll never go to anything other than that because one, I don't want to put in the effort. I don't want to spend all the money. I don't think it helps the plants. And by consistently selecting generation after generation in this, I'm making the Hemerocallis not only as strong as the fulva, but hopefully stronger. What I am trying to do is accelerated evolution.
I definitely like to highlight to people, if your garden can grow weeds, if it grows an abundant crop of weeds, it should have no problem growing an abundant crop of crops, because crops are descended from weeds for the like pretty much every case you care to look at. So yeah,
That's right.
if you're getting sucked into doing all of the inputs that the very helpful people in the nursery will take your money in exchange for, then you're probably going down a path that will, it's a never-ending task once you start down the path of high input farming. Whereas
That's right.
if you take that effort to do the breeding and the selection to get low put input working, then you've basically solved a problem forever.
That's right. And one of the problems with attempting low input is that too many people are attempting low input with plants that have been selected through generation after generation of high input and don't have the genetic capacity to survive it. So there has to be a certain period where you do a testing period to figure out. Of course, now you can go to some people and buy plants or buy seeds of plants that have been grown in low input conditions, or there are known Grexes or, gene lines that are known to flourish in low input conditions. But if you go to the standard things the nurseries are trying to sell, whether you're looking at food plants or ornamentals, a lot of times you're looking at things that have had a lot of selection and evolution in the wrong direction, and they may not flourish. But so let's say you go and you buy a pack of tomatoes and they're, Big Boy or Beefsteak or something that are not going to do as well in low input because they've been selected for high input for so long. If you get one plant that'll flourish and you can save seeds from it, if you get one plant that even just survives and makes a few tomatoes and select seeds from it, you can start changing those plants through selection. The genome is plastic.
Yeah.
I
Well,
mean, that's evolution.
I
Go
was
ahead.
about to ask, do you think there might be more going on with selection than just simple Mendelian genetics?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, there's epigenetics. Epigenetics are where a lot of the action is happening. I like to say that DNA is the library, but RNA are the librarians. They're the ones that are taking the information and doing everything with it, and epigenetics is where so much of this is mediated. The daylilies are wildly epigenetically mediated, more so than almost any plant I've ever worked with, because the environmental conditions can change the color of the flower, it can change the scape height, the foliage texture. There's all of these traits in daylilies that it looks like this in your garden in Florida, but it doesn't look like that in my garden in Kentucky, and it doesn't look like either of our gardens when it's in Minnesota. And even something I've noticed here on this farm, where we have slightly different soil types. I'm on the drier southern side. My mom and aunt are up on the top of the hill on the flat area where they farmed for a century. It's richer with a deeper soil. Things will perform differently in my gardens than they perform in their gardens, and I can throw a rock and hit their house from mine. So how much different then are daylilies going to perform from Florida to Minnesota or from Kentucky to California? There's always going to be a variation, but like a peony cultivar looks the same in almost any garden it'll grow in. The flowers don't change just because they're in different gardens. They may do better or less well, but they don't change. But the daylily will change. It's wildly epigenetically mediated. And that's all environmental inputs. And so, yeah, there's a lot going on. And, once you get an epigene to turn on, it will then pass genetically, just like DNA. It's heritable. So the key is, if you're trying to grow a crop, and see, what I did was when I went into this, I went in knowing some of the stuff that was the toughest. And so I brought in those base plants that I knew were going to be tough to begin with. And then I brought in fancies and I tested them and found what was equally tough. But let's say you're wanting to grow beans or corn or tomatoes or whatever it is, and you don't have access to someone who's already created the plants for low input, you can take the regular commercial stock and grow it, and it's not going to do well. But you can take the few that survived and reproduced and take their seeds, and over a few generations, you can begin to make really significant change because the environment will turn on and off epigenes. It's not a matter of with DNA, we're waiting for a mutation. It's like, oh, if I could get this mutation, and you might, and then you might not for 10,000 years. It's just that's random. But epigenes can be turned on and off based on the environment. And in fact, the environment will trigger epigenes if they're there.
The environmental challenges that your local growing space experiences, I look on them now as a resource, because if you lived in like this perfect, everything was perfect and you were breeding a crop, you wouldn't have the ability to develop drought resistance or pest resistance or anything.
That's correct. 100% correct. And I view it the same way. And I view my dry, hot, sandy, clay southern exposure as not a hindrance, but as a gift. Another big thing that we have with daylilies, some of them are evergreen and some of them are dormant or deciduous or whatever you want to call it. In the daylily world, it's called dormant, although I don't know that they're truly dormant. But anyhow, so there's two different foliage types, and then the intermediates of those are called semi-evergreen, which is a silly word, but don't even get me started on that. But anyhow, some evergreens are not hardy in cold climates. Some of the dormants do not do well in tropical climates. So that's a whole thing to consider too. But when you are looking at the daylilies, there's this thing that goes on in cold climates where some daylilies, even if they're hardy there, will start growing at the first hint of warmth, and they will be up growing vigorously. And then you'll get a late freeze. We get this all the time here in my area. And that will set them back, and it will cause problems with the flowering, especially if they're early blooming cultivars, which most of the evergreen types from Florida are. And you have this thing happen where the early growers that get hit with those late freezes have what I call late freeze intolerance. And that causes problems with the plants. But then you have other plants that come up later, or that just naturally have, they've come up early, but they have freeze tolerance. They don't have resistance, but they have tolerance. They can get hit by those same hard freezes, and even if they bloom early, they don't have any problems. Now, the plants that get hit with those hard late freezes and have a problem with it also then are more susceptible to thrip attacks in the early spring. So the daylilies I have found that have the most late freeze tolerance that are early flowering also typically will have higher thrips resistance as well. And that all seems to be kind of epigenetically mediated because that's all about the environment and how they respond to it. And what I have done is in my early program, the early flowering plants, I have selected strictly for those that have the freeze tolerance plus the high thrips resistance. And now I'm starting to see plants with even higher freeze tolerance and higher freeze resistance and higher thrips resistance than the best ones that I started with. And I suspect that has some kind of epigenetic mediation because I'm growing them in the conditions where they get that every year.
Yeah. Now, you're in an interesting position to talk about the social networks that tie breeders together because you're on the, correct me if I'm wrong, you're kind of on the periphery of a very large, very vibrant, ornamental plant breeding community.
Yes.
And I have no doubt that you've interacted with that at some point in the past.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think people trying to build networks around breeding newer crops for lower inputs, this whole kind of world that I'm in. Do you think there are any lessons or warnings that we can take from established larger plant breeding communities like the day lily breeding community?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There are pros and cons. One of the things that I knew going in, because I know myself very well, was that I would need to stay on the periphery. The daylily world has tried to pull me in more, and they're great people. There's a lot of really great people in the daylily world, and I kind of hate the fact that I can't be more participatory with them than I am. But I also know that the minute you get in there and you're starting to work with them, there's going to be peer pressure going on. They're going to be, oh, why, you've got to get this flower. One of the things the flower people tell me all the time is, oh, you've got to improve your flowers. Oh, your plants are good, but you've really got to improve the flowers. And I'm like, they will be improved patiently over time. The genes are there. You don't understand what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So I try to avoid the peer pressure while also participating as much as I possibly can because there's a lot to be learned there. You can go to them. I went to them and asked them what plants flourish for you. If you are growing something out in the field or you've got it in the back of the field where they're not getting good inputs or where there's a lot of weeds, what flourishes back there, And there was a lot of information I couldn't get because they just didn't know it, They just most daylily breeders were not going to know what thrived in a drought year because they were watering or things like that. But I was able to gather quite a bit of very useful information. And plus, I want my plants to go out to the daylily world. I'm not just breeding for a permacultural world. I'm not just breeding for a flower world. I'm breeding for both. And honestly, I've really had very little interaction with the permaculture world here in the United States because they all frown on daylilies. Because, the U.S. agricultural system calls the ditch lily an invasive, a foreign invasive, which, at this time, that cat's out of the bag. There's no putting it back in. So, and they in the permacultural world, I think here in the U.S., they kind of look at what I'm doing is I'm just a flower breeder who's pretending to be a permaculturalist is the kind of vibe I get. But then the daylily people are like, well, you're just focused on the plants and you don't focus on flowers, which is not true at all. But I want most of my plants, anything I introduce, I want daylily people working with it because it's what I call stealth resistance. And where I've done all this work for resistance with thrips and rust. If I can get my plants to them, even if they're just buying it because of the flower, and they'll use it in their breeding program, they're going to get those genes in there whether they want them or not. So I consider it a stealth program, which the aim is to inject vigor in. Now, my program in a lot of ways was designed to create breeding stock for daylily people to use to invigorate faltering lines, but they're too proud to do it much. There are a few who are doing it. And then there's a set of people within that community who are interested in the more species-looking flowers, and they often, are customers or friends and people that I know. But I one little dirt road I'm going to go on for just a moment is that I also did a diploid program at the beginning because I wasn't sure I could do what I wanted to do with tetraploids, and having a diploid program was an insurance policy so that I
Yeah.
could do something with daylilies if the
Very
tets didn't work
smart.
out.
Very smart.
Yeah, But once I knew the tests were going to work out, then I basically discontinued the diploid program, and I've been in the process of gradually getting all the diploids out of here. But I had a lot of plants that went through the rust resistance screening that were beautiful flowers, fancy flowers that also had really high rust resistance. And so I've introduced those and sold those. And I've probably introduced more diploids than tetraploids at this point, because a tetraploid is a long process that I'm only now coming into where I really want to be and to be working from. Whereas the diploids were, I didn't have to do anything to make them. I was just crossing fancy flowers and selecting for rust resistance. And so the highly rust resistant plants from that part of the program could be introduced and gotten out to daylily people so that they could just grow them, in the South and use them in their breeding programs. So I do want to reach out to the permacultural people here in the U.S. more. I have a lot of plants, some of my best tetraploid introductions from the earliest parts of my program, what I would call foundational introductions, are extremely good for permacultural uses. There are a whole group of those that are extremely good. So when you look at my range of introductions, I have about a 120 or maybe a few more than that cultivars at this point. Most of my introductions are diploids and they're flower bred. So that's flower breeding. That's all for the daylily flower world, where my foundational tetraploids are for the flower world and are for the permacultural world at the same time, and they're what I'm building my own program out of, so that it's accessible to both groups. But I would like to reach out to the permacultural world more. It's just that, I've posted about it on those Facebook groups and, reached out to various people, and there hasn't seemed to be much of an interest.
I'm going to have to hype you up because I can't think of a perennial low input crop suitable for like those wider zones in permaculture systems that has a better genetic base to become adapted for permaculture. And it's kind of baffling that nobody's giving it attention so far. So I'm going to be helping to cheerlead you and your work and
Well,
this
thank you.
crop. And this crop, I think it's ready for the big time.
Well, I appreciate that, and I think it is too. And especially now, like my introduction, Korean Queen. I eat the flowers of that one all the time, and she's delicious, and she grows like crazy. And in down here in the dry part of the farm, she gets maybe scapes are 3 feet tall. Up in my aunt's garden, where there's richer soil, the scapes were 45 inches this year, and just covered in branches and buds. So it is mildly rhizomatous. It'll send out little runners. It won't take over the farm, but it will spread. So it has excellent applications for both permacultural uses, for culinary, and for erosion control. And I think it would be an excellent one. The spice must flow is good. That's one of my big introductions. But the spice must flow, I will say that's one of the ones that isn't necessarily culinary. It's a little more pharmaceutical, and that's part of the ideal of the name, because the spice is in the Dune series, Frank Herbert's Dune series, is a, what would you call it? It's definitely, it has hallucinogenic, it
Performance
has
enhancer.
psychotropic property. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And of course, it has a purple parent and a red parent. The red parent has the ditch lily as its pod parent. And I've noticed that a lot of the purple ones seem to have a little bit more of that psychotropic effect. And I think there's something in the anthocyanins going on there. But I don't know. I can't say for sure. It's just a guess. But it certainly has some permacultural applications. And I have produced seedlings from it that are bright orange or yellow and do not have that effect. They're just food
Interesting.
plant.
Yeah, interesting.
The introduction Far Above the World is a big pale yellow. It has culinary applications. So I have them. They're there. And I think the permacultural world could benefit from them. Two things I would say to anyone interested in permacultural listening to this who might be interested in them or who might, be horrified by the thought, these aren't going to take over creation. These are not invasives. These are not the ditch lily, even though they have those genes in them. The rhizomatous traits are recessive, and when you're talking about breeding at the tetraploid level, you're not talking about a 1-4 to get a recessive to come back out. You're talking about something more like 116 or 124 or 156 for one gene. So it's a whole different ball of wax at that level. But I think a lot of permacultural people just think, well, I'll just use the ditch lily. I don't need your plants. I'm just going to use the ditch lily. And that's fine. Use them. That's great. But I think mine are more selected. I think they're better garden specimens. And if you are a permacultural person who has any interest in the visual application, mine are prettier. And I do. I don't want a garden that's ugly. I want a garden that's productive and that flows with nature. But why shouldn't it feed the soul too? Why shouldn't it be pretty? Our ancestors certainly were capable to select for both phenotype and use at the same time.
I look at how the bees and the butterflies and the birds transformed plants into all the beauty that we see around us. And now humans are joining that party. We're part of that dynamic and we're creating new forms of beauty that suit our own aesthetics. It's part of the relationship with a plant.
I agree. I agree. I feel it's a type of communion. I will say, though, the problem with humans doing it is that we can then go into all the artificial inputs and we can select beauty that couldn't survive in nature. I'm interested in beauty that can survive in nature. I would like it so that if there were a catastrophe and humans were gone and some other species arose and evolved to sentient consciousness in a million years, that they would think some of the daylilies I had bred were a species.
I love that. It reminds me of how crops like pumpkins used to be, they were created by megafauna, and now the megafauna are gone. We've kind of taken over. We're like the second spouse in that relationship. And yeah, I love that vision of breeding crops that aren't just for humans. They're for the next however many million years of complex life are left on the planet.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, and the notion that mine would survive, that like the species daylilies, if we were gone, they would potentially still be here. They don't require us, to exist. We do nothing for them. In other words, Europa will survive whether we're here or not. But most fancy daylilies will not, because before long the weeds will take them over and they won't be able to persist under them, or the clump will overgrow itself and kill itself out, and they don't have the reproductive mechanisms then that the species, because there are species that do that, but what the species do that is they then the middle of the clump dies out and the pieces on the side then make their own clump. And so that's how they spread. They are moving slowly. But that's not how they work with these plant with most of the cultivars. When they die out in the center, oftentimes they have to be dug and divided and replanted and refreshed to get the pieces that are left around the edges to kick back off with good growth. And not all daylilies do that, and that's a trait that I hate. And the daylily people are so focused on the flowers that they're not part of it. They would select against that if they were growing the daylilies long enough to recognize it, but they're dividing them constantly to sell and to increase. And so they often don't see the kind of things that I was privileged to be able to see by having daylilies as a child and then letting those gardens sit there through 10 or 20 or 30 years of doing other stuff and then going back to them and, oh, these three are still here and the other six are gone, and saying, okay, then we'll keep these three. So go ahead.
We should probably start getting towards the final questions. I could talk to you for all
Sure.
day, for days, and I'm sure I will have you back to talk again in the future because you've got other projects that I'm fascinated by. But as a kind of rounding off set of questions, what is your vision for the future of food in your community?
Well, I don't know because, I don't interface with my community a whole lot. And I know that's kind of a not necessarily a great thing. I live way up in the hills in Appalachia and I don't interface with my surroundings a lot. But I would, there are a lot of people, though, in my area who are growing food crops. We have a lot of Mennonites here in the local area who grow local food crops and they're not doing as much high input. So I think that I'm in one of the few areas that I wouldn't say it's food secure, but it has a higher potential for being food secure than most places do because, as recent as my grandparents, they were still subsistence farming when I was a child. So most people here have some grasp of what that is and what that means. And almost everyone here, is growing a few tomatoes or something. I mean, granted, some of them are doing inputs, but a lot of people don't. And the inputs a lot of people use around here still is manure. I know the Mennonites, a lot of their input is manure.
Do you think the Mennonites would be open to growing your best selections?
I doubt it, and I try not to interface with deeply religious people if I can help it. I know that sounds snobbish and horrible, but I just don't, because I'm going to accidentally say the word evolution, or I'm going to accidentally use a scientific term, or I'm going to say something they're going to have a problem with that's been consistent throughout my whole life. And so I've just found, live and let live. They can do their thing, and I do my thing. I think if they grew them, they would probably like them and find them useful. But then you would have to be introducing them to this concept of eating them and why to eat them. And I don't know. I just don't know. It's just not something I personally have thought about much, because I don't interface with the local community tremendously. Basically, there are times when I don't leave the farm for months at a time.
It's an interesting
I'm
problem because people like you and me who are quite happy to spend 30 years alone in the garden working on these kind of projects, we're not necessarily also the kind of people who can build a community organization and get other people involved.
Well,
So
we're not promoters. I mean, I'm not a promoter. I do a lot of promotion. I run my Facebook page, and I try to post frequently and blah, blah, blah. I try to keep all of that out there and keep my presence in the daylily world and try to make inroads into other areas where I can. But I'm just not a promoter. I'm not a people person. I'm an introvert, and that's just not my bag. And so, yeah, it is hard. It's hard. You have to network, because you want to get this stuff out there, and then yet the networking is always the part that's nerve-wracking for me.
I'm starting to wonder if the last phase of a crop breeder's life is the when they have less physical energy to manage a large garden, but they've got the most results of all that work to share. That might be the best time in life to just say, screw it, I'm going to go out and talk to people rather than break my back in the garden for another 5 years. Because
I
otherwise,
agree. I agree. But I also think the other key, one of the things I've found in daylilies, is by making friends with the people who are out there and are people, and who are willing to get out and talk and promote. If I send plants to them and get my plants into their gardens where they can see what they can do, they will often then do some level of promotion with my plants, not like in a commercial sense, but in the sense that they talk about them and people come to their gardens and see them. I don't do open gardens. I don't, I, you know, because daylily people, they want to come to your garden. They want to show the up at sunrise. They want to trot through the garden all day in blazing heat and looking at the plants, and all they want to talk about are the flowers. And I love them. They're great people. There's nothing wrong with those people. It's if there's something wrong with anyone, it's me. I don't want to do it. To me, that's a waste of time for my day. And it's just like, I spent this whole day with you and we talked about nothing that's of interest to me. And, and that's fine. But if I send them out into these other gardens that I know do these garden tours and have people coming through and everything, then my plants get seen. But the other thing I think people like you and I need to do is we just have to make those connections with people who are interested in what we do, but are more A-type social personalities that are willing to go out and talk about it and willing to do the promoting. And one of the ways I have found to sort of interface and do that is just by getting my plants into their garden, letting them see what they'll do.
The results speak for themselves.
That's right.
Who do you think I should interview next? Have you got any dream guests that you're like, I want to see Shane pick their brain for an hour?
I have no idea. I am such an introvert that I couldn't tell you what's going on. Like, for instance, people right now are all the time telling me, daylily people are all the time when they're talking to me, they're saying, "Oh, you need to get this. So and so's got this new plant that they've just, oh, have you seen so?" I don't see any of it and never look at any of it. So with the daylily world, I don't know. With the permaculture world, I don't know. I don't know what's going on in it. Basically, I've taken from permaculture what works for me. And I kind of avoid everything because human interpersonal relations kind of wear on me. I just feel like it drains my energy to even have to read it in a group. And so I kind of avoid everything. I mean, Finding the post you had made on Facebook was quite a coincidence. I don't even quite know how it happened because I hadn't been in that group in a while, but I had posted something to that group, and when I was in it liking someone's comment on what I had posted, I thought, well, let's see what's been in this group, and I just scrolled down and found your post. So it was just one of those chance things. But that's another thing I would suggest to people who are introverts and who are content to ignore the greater world is really pay attention to like synchronicities and random chance. That's played a huge role in my life as an introvert since I'm not out there, moving and shaking, is if something intrudes into my seclusion, I pay attention to that.
Well, I'll take that moment to put a call out to the audience that I'm always looking for crop breeders or low input producers or people who have a knack for social networking in these fields, and also just out there, weirdo thinkers who are interested in history and ecology and the future. Or give me an email, give me a pitch. I'm very open-minded to new guests in the future.
And I would say I would love to hear from anyone in the permaculture world or otherwise who wants to talk about the work I'm doing or whatever. I find it interesting. I do enjoy talking with people. I do enjoy sharing ideas. I especially love to talk about what I'm doing with my program. So it's not that I don't want contact. I do want contact. I'm good with one-on-one contact.
I'm usually the same. That's why I love podcasting so much. This is kind of my way of reaching out to the world. On that note, how can people learn more about your work or get in touch? And I'll put links in the show notes so that people don't have to try
Sure.
and write it down.
Well, my page on Facebook is Sun Dragon Daylilies. That's the business name I work under. And that's Sundragon, Sun Dragon, and then, of course, Daylilies. And you can easily find that on Facebook. My website is sundragondaylilies.com. Very easy to find. And then I have my blog, which is daylilybreeder.blogspot.com. And of course, that is linked on both the Facebook page and the website. My sales go strictly through the website. I don't do any kind of sales on Facebook, although people can contact me and ask me about things certainly through Facebook. And those are the main ways. And my email addresses are on the I think the email address is on the website, and it's sundragondaylilies@gmail.com.
And
So
I will
basically,
highly recommend people who are thinking about starting a serious breeding program to check out the writings, particularly I think it was the blog, where you actually kind of outlined the whole chronology and strategy of your project that's taken so many years to put together. I think that's a really very, very rare opportunity to see somebody who's been that introspective about how they have achieved so much.
well, thank you.
And what it, I know, after you,
That was the whole plan with it, was for people to be able to utilize that and apply it to their own programs.
yes. So, what is your final message for people thinking about getting into crop breeding or local agriculture, low input, all of these kind of things?
Oh, just do it and don't worry about what seem like failures. Your failures are your best friends. There are no failures. Failure is only the universe directing you in a different direction.
That is
You
a
know, so just, yeah, just do it.
that is a beautiful thought to finish on, because that's what this show is all about. It's if I can prompt another 1,000 people out there to start a breeding program when the time is right in their life, then I will feel like my work has been done.
Great. One other thing I would add to that is listen to people to a certain extent, but don't listen to people. Because if you are trying to do something new or unusual or revolutionary, everyone's going to have a problem with it. So just do it and don't worry about it. And if you fail at it, keep at it. Because if there's a real basis to what you're trying to do, it'll start to happen, even if it takes a few generations to start seeing it.
Brilliant. And on that final note, Brian, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been great to speak with you.
The Zero Input Agriculture Podcast is a solo passion project built with my ample time and meager resources. If you would like to support the show, then sign up for a paid subscription to my Zero Input Agriculture blog at Substack. As a reward, you can read all my past posts and listen to the audiobook of Taming the Apocalypse. If you prefer reading about the past and future of biological technology, you can read the ebook of Taming the Apocalypse through Amazon. And finally, please rate and review the show on whatever podcast app you use, since it helps other people find me, or recommend the show directly to anyone who could use some inspiration to become a plant breeder themselves.